Welcome to Catholic Theological Union's podcast. This podcast, recorded on April 29th, 2015, features a conversation between Dr. Paul Farmer and the CTU community. Dr. Farmer is a renowned physician, anthropologist, and co-founder of Partners in Health. He received the Blessed Are the Peacemakers Award at CTU's annual trustee dinner.
I'm honored to be invited, especially as, like many people in this room, I really don't think there can be peacemakers who are not interested in justice work. You know, and slogan though it may sound, I believe every word of that. And so I am a peaceful fellow. It's true, but also, you know, struggle. And as you said, think about struggle with some of the things that one can readily see in this country and every other. And so it's really a nice little bit of respite just to be here for a day and an evening. I'm headed back to Liberia, actually, from here. So I know, so let's start. And I'm not in a rush either. They may be in a rush to get rid of me, but as you will see, I have a handy facility with the microphone to try to cut me off at Harvard.
Questions for Dr. Farmer, we will bring microphones around.
Or just general unstinting praise will do as well.
I'd be happy to contribute to the general unstinting praise. Paul, we know that you were greatly influenced by Gustavo Gutierrez's work and your friendship with him, and then you co-authored a book with him. Could you say a little bit about how did you get so passionate about your commitment to the poor and to the justice and peace work? How did you get onto that pathway?
Funny you should ask me that, Barbara. You know, because I would have to credit, actually, sort of a reintroduction. I mean, the short answer to that is Haiti. One word. But before that, I got to meet in North Carolina some friends of the United Farm Workers, and they were nuns, actually, well, a lot of them. They were, you know, helping drive the movement forward from California to North Carolina. I went to Duke University as an undergraduate, and I was already interested in Haiti. Although I said to some, when you were moderating a talk, I told the assembled students that I had wanted to go to West Africa, and I had applied for a Fulbright, and was really confident, oh, I'll get a Fulbright. I mean, I'm really, really good. And I didn't even get an interview. So Haiti was plan B, but that didn't mean I wasn't interested in Haitians and Haiti and Haitian art and Haitian everything. And I was writing a long format article for a student publication. It was like 12,000 words about migrant farm workers and how migrant farm labor was conscripted into slavery-like conditions. And again, you all know this, but I was 21 when I was rediscovering how labor was exploited, not to sound too 19th century. And then I met people organizing against the exploitation. And when I realized that, I mean, I understood they were nuns. I mean, I had to go meet with them and call them sister. I had this unreasonable fear, by the way, some PTSD thing. I'm just kidding. I forgot you're taping this. So that really got me to thinking. And a year later, when I went to Haiti, I met more people who were inspired by faith. It was difficult circumstances, the end of a dictatorship, although no one knew that then. Well, at least I didn't. And then I started reading liberation theology, particularly. And that's how I met Gustavo Gutierrez. In other words, almost 8 years before I met him in Peru. I just saw him, by the way, so I was just in Peru. And let's just say my older daughter is a lot taller than you are, so I have some really good pictures with her and Gustavo. So the concise answer and some more backstory. It took me a while to digest this. I'm still digesting it.
I wanted to ask you, you and Gustavo both talk about one world. Let's stop talking about first world, second world, third world, fourth world, but one world. And you have a vision of global health, and you were trying to do some of that education to people also with the Ebola crisis. I'm wondering if you could talk about what that might look like, and especially U.S.'s participation in that. And the second hat I wear here is we started a new center for the study of consecrated life, and nuns are part of that, so I'm not religious in the Sacred Heart. And a question is, so where, how would you invite and challenge and call forth religious and folks in consecrated life at this time? So the two questions. They're small and easy.
No problem.
Yeah.
Well, this is a chance for me to also acknowledge that the Gustavo book was the Jenny Block's idea. So Jenny is a former RSCJ, and it was her idea. She knew that we were friends, and I'd written about Gustavo, I don't want to forget to say that. It was a great experience. You didn't ask me about that question, but the understanding that it's one world, not three, is a political economy understanding, and a historical understanding and a sociological understanding. It's all of these undeniable ways of seeing social process in the world. And that includes, for me, the term social process means economic processes. And, you know, it's a very all-encompassing term. I ended up studying medicine and anthropology in part because, you know, it was a little bit overwhelming to go from the United States to Haiti and then back to medical school, you know, just 1 year. No, it wasn't a little overwhelming, it was very overwhelming. And it was also part of an internal fiction that it was a great year. You know, I kind of spent years saying, oh, it's great, I just love the time I spent there, and I can't wait to get back. And it took me years to say, well, actually, it was not wonderful. And it was frightening and upsetting and full of loss. And so there's also the maturity of understanding personal processes or less, you know, getting it less wrong. For me is part of continuing to really plow forward with an analysis so that I can not pretend that it's three worlds, right? And I think humans are really good at pretending that, you know, our neighbor isn't, you know, someone we can't see. You know, but in ethics, the quandary ethics of the individual completely dominate our discussions in medicine, as I'm sure you know. And it's good that we know how to focus on the quandary ethics of the individual. Any doctor or nurse or, you know, religious, but I'll get to the second question in a second, has to pay attention to the person or family in front of them. So I'm not saying quandary in ethics of the individual as if that were not an important thing to understand. But it's only part of the problem, right? If you see, you know, if I see a patient in Boston one day and I can be in Haiti the next day, you know, American Airlines, thank you. It used to be Air Florida, American Air Florida. How about that? That's last from the past, Jenny. There's plenty of ways of, epidemic disease is obviously a great reminder that we live in one world, not three in some senses. So, I know that Gustavo came to that, and Oscar Romero, and lots of other people who you'll know more about than I do, but who were very inspiring to me, understood, and go case by case, if you want to understand, as they'd say in my other field, my field, I don't have two fields, but I do, but I'm not pretending I'm a theologian, Mark, I promise. A sudden spike in mortality in, El Salvador in, 1980, you better be willing to look where the bullets come from and how they're financed and all these other unpleasant things that, drove forward at least my reading and writing. I think also our practice, or my practice as a physician with lots of other people in various other roles. So I got to Gustavo from reading, as I just said, and something just really struck me as, true. How's that for a non-postmodernist term? And of course, you could read a similar analysis. It used to be called the political economic analysis, but which I mean historically accountable and geographically inclusive, so that you would understand the link between, let's say, an arms manufacturer in the Midwest and bullets that killed, a nun in El Salvador. You do that homework, like I would have about an epidemic. But again, not the most cheerful kind of stuff to contemplate, and so it was kind of a relief that Gustavo is, in fact, a cheerful person, yes? It's very difficult to teach medicine and bring in that perspective, in my experience, right? Because we're trained, and I only mention that because I am a teacher largely of physicians, and I don't walk into a ward to see patients and start talking about the transnational political economy of pharmaceuticals. I'd be hounded out. And I wouldn't do that. It's not really what I'm in there to do. But that doesn't mean I won't write about it and talk about it at any chance I get. And sometimes you'd get a chance because of epidemic disease, which is always, by definition, translocal. See why I told you I'm not rushing to get out of here, Mark. And, one of the things turning to the second question, I don't mean, I wouldn't have presumed to try and answer it, but you asked me, and here's the PTSD thing going when sister asked me, I say, right away. But, I think one of the things that I've really found helpful as someone who is involved in direct service to people living in poverty and encouraging others to become involved, again, whether they're doctors or nurses or supply chain people or managers or academics or business people in Chicago. I mentioned Chicago because Chicago supporters were probably the largest supporters of the University Hospital project in Haiti after the earthquake, mostly. I mean, the people from all over the country, certainly Boston as well, but it's really, people here that help move that forward. So, one of the things that I've found really encouraging that seems to come largely from religious communities, at least in my experience, is a kind of encouragement that's so rooted in first principles. And sometimes you get that in a university or in some sort of other institution, right? Let's just say if you're looking for support from a foundation or philanthropy. And I've had, and I can't tell you how much support from Harvard. So I'd be the last person who would have any personal grievance against the secular world that I move in. I don't have a personal grievance. The grievance is about question one. How can we stand by and see how unequal the world remains and in many ways it's getting worse? The encouragement from people who are engaged in social justice work because they've made these radical commitments, because they're religious and clergy, I find very, very sustaining. I don't know if you thought I would say that as my answer. In other words, the subtext is, the role of the religious and clergy is to give me moral and mental support. But really, for everybody, you know, who is involved in difficult work, you know, there's just a lot of, workers are involved in difficult work. But I'm saying there's a lot of, I think it's a huge role, in addition to the prophetic voice. It's the Islands of Mercy. And it's meant a lot over the years to many of us. You know. That's really what Gustavo was always doing, you know, saying, "Keep going. You guys are doing the right thing." And this in his country, where we were facing a really strong undercurrent of censorious opinion from the public health and academic and political, the secular world, and that wasn't fun. I mean, unless you like losing a popularity contest, isn't really not very pleasant. But again, people who had made commitments about the sanctity of human life and its value were stalwarts throughout that, and every other experience we've had in difficult times. So don't stop that part of it.
I'm the founder president of a charitable organization known as Care and Share. Over the last 25 years, we gave away $1.6 million around the world supporting 150 institutions. In India, we do mainly the medical charity through the Catholic hospitals and Catholic institutions. I wonder whether you have any interest in doing some charity work in India. I can easily coordinate.
Is that the question?
Yes.
Well, that's easy. I mean, I'm not going to say, no, I have no interest in doing. So, yes. Partners in Health is, if you look at, when I reflect on the last 30 years, the answer to Sister Barbara's question being Haiti, that's more than 30 years since I went there, and a lot of the people who founded Partners in Health, a fairly small group, were connected through Haiti. And in the years since, you know, there are many organizations that they're in, you know, all over the world. They're in many places at once. Emergency response organizations, for example. You know, if you look at what's happening in Nepal, saving Baltimore for later. But if you look at what's happening in Nepal, there will be a roster of organizations that reliably show up and help. That's, Partners in Health is not that kind of organization. And in between the engagements that we've made in West Africa, which are and were about health system strengthening and not any particular epidemic, and the previous such commitments is 10 years. So Rwanda, Malawi, and Lesotho is getting close to 10 years ago since we made commitments there. Because, you know, that's really, you know, what we do. We want to, and it's a partnership of people, so there are academics involved and volunteers and ministries of health, public authorities, and NGOs and church groups. But the idea is not to, you know, pretend that we could be everywhere, and because this is really in-depth, long-term systems-building that we're trying to do. Building, you know, there's so many cliches and terrible jargon expression, you know, there's so much terrible jargon now. You know, I almost caught myself saying things like building local capacity, which gets translated, by the way, into local capacity building. And it's just that you hear these so often that you get numbed to them. But it does mean something, right? So it's building a university hospital, say, in the middle of a rural area of Haiti, and training Haitian doctors and nurses and managers and supply chain experts. And so in Rwanda, and so everywhere we've worked. And the good side of that is it's enduring because it's not just infrastructure projects, but also, you know, here I am doing it again, building human capital. And so when I say, oh yes, I'd very much be very much interested in working in India, that's been true for a long time. But, you know, partners in hell, because my student, can you imagine how many students I have at Harvard who ask me that same question about, particularly India, China, Vietnam. And, you know, I've been saying for years, well, you know, won't be anytime soon because, you know, we'd have to make a collective commitment for the long term.
Have you ever been to India before?
I have. Okay. I have. Yeah, I have. And I've read a lot. I've taught a course last fall with Amartya Sen, who is the economist, who is a wonderful person and great person to teach with. Actually, it was the Gustavo book that gave him the idea for us to teach a seminar together. And spent spent a lot of time reading about India's often very appalling record on health outcomes. And I think part of the reason that, you know, we're not there is humility, modesty, knowing that, you know, what is required is, again, I think that sort of approach, linking to public sector capacity, focusing on implementation, improving quality of care, you know, that long laundry list. And we have no experience of that taking less than decades, you know, of our involvement. Now, others may be a lot better and obviously better rooted. And we have many colleagues working there, or working with colleagues there.
I've spent a lot of time in Sierra Leone, and one of the things that I think also that I'd be curious about how you've dealt with or addressed is things like the actual culture and people not really understanding what's going on. For example, when Ebola broke out initially, people were horrified and terrified of these people in these uniforms, so they ran away. So they had to learn not to put on all the healthcare stuff because the people wouldn't go to them. Now that Ebola is kind of under control there right now, people are terrified to go to a hospital because they think they're going to die, so they can't even get anyone near a hospital. And it seems like a lot of this type of stuff, people don't seem to go for a lot of these problems in the whole sort of cultural makeup of the country and the problems, and things get very bad because of that. So I'm curious how you approach when you go into a new place that has all kinds of strange cultural things, how you deal with that in general.
Well, yeah, first of all, I have no doubt that you know a lot more about Sierra Leone than I do. I've never been there until June. And for a meeting on, guess what, health system strengthening. Yesterday, we launched the Lancet Commission on Surgical Care. So, and that was the occasion for the visit. I knew precisely three Sierra Leoneans at that point. And one of them, they're all three physicians. One of them is my student in a graduate program, and working with Partners in Health, and has been nonstop since that summer. One died of Ebola on July 29th, and the other died of Ebola on November 17th. So, you know, let's just say it's been a crash course in Sierra Leonean specificities. And, you know, getting back to the examples, you know, if I were Sierra Leonean and had grown up in Eastern or Western Sierra Leone, I'd be very frightened if I saw people in uniforms too. And, you know, and you know, whether all memory is surely cultural, right? But that's not even remote memory. The brutal civil war, you know, that's 2002. To me, that seems like yesterday. And I'm sure it may to you as well. And some of the other, you know, cultural, the term was used a lot, as you know, by political and public health commentators. And, you know, just the example that I won't leave unmentioned of funerary ritual, back to CCD, it's all your fault. You know, bury the dead. That's one of the corporal works of mercy. And, you know, as an adult, of course, a child growing up, I had no experience with burying the dead. But once I went to Haiti, I understood that there was no, as the California whiz kids like to say, delivery platform for dignified burial of the dead. It was all privatized and always had been by families. And so is most caregiving, right? It's not, by privatized, I just mean that families are responsible not only for burying the dead, but for tending the ill. With the exceptions being, by the way, people like you, who, that's why Ebola, by the way, preferentially takes out nuns. Ebola makes a preferential option for the nun, for sure. All the epidemics, all the major outbreaks, the first one, Yambuku, when it was described, 1976, look at the history, and it happened again and again, it happened this way, it takes out caregivers. And so the central lesion, you know, and you really ask, how do we take that on? Well, you, the thing that I think we've tried to do, which is to, you know, back to the question of India too, is to set down roots to make it clear we're not, you know, coming and about to disappear. And so between that first trip, in June, and October, when we really said, okay, as Partners in Health, you know, that the board of Partners in Health said, yes, you may go. So between October and now, and just in Sierra Leone and in Liberia, we have 1,500 employees. And, you know, many of them are, a quarter of them, I think, are probably Ebola survivors, right? So that's, you know, part of the answer to the question is we're trying to be part of a community in the middle of an emergency, and then to say we're not going anywhere. And so the running away from question is a very different one from that vantage point. And I know there have been acts of violence against people involved in Ebola work, and no one would ever make light of that, I hope. But it's very different if you're living and working in a place, as, you know, as I'm sure, you know, has been your experience. So community health workers is another example. Where do people run away to? Well, they run home. Oh, in the middle of an armed conflict, they may run into the forest or anywhere that there's shelter. But in peacetime, it's largely into a village, their home village. But that's where the community health workers are. So the front line, or the first point of first contact, is ideally not in some place where a patient's already critically ill, and, you know, someone like me is in full regalia. It's preferably much earlier. And again, that's ideally. In Haiti, you know, we have the hospitals, like the one I was describing. Or was that at lunch only? Have I been droning on? I was droning on about the hospital. Hospital, clinic, but also community health workers that are right there, your neighbors. So That's part of it, is a structural response to what, again, not to sound too much like a 19th century political economist, but are structural problems, right? These beliefs, these cultural beliefs, come from somewhere, and they always come from somewhere, and they're rooted in a near total absence, as far as I can see, for hundreds of years, in efforts to serve the poor when they're sick or dying or dead. So, and this is the slave coast, right? I mean, you know, when you look, when I go there and I say, wow, some of these people look like Haitians, there's a reason for that. You know, they really do look like Haitians. So this transnational political economy view is, again, just been absent from this Ebola response, just completely absent. And if you walk in the middle of an epidemic and start going on about slavery or war or colonialism, not very welcome, nor should it be, right? But it's got to be in here somewhere, you know? Even if it doesn't, it's not pertinent to the conversation in the middle of a crisis. I think maybe if it's tucked away in here, you know, it's helpful. It's soothing. It's consoling. And I think it's helped my coworkers. On the Sierra Leonean side, they're almost shocked when you bring anything like this up. You know, any knowledge of their circumstance and its origins, shocked. It's been my experience again and again there, and Liberia too, interestingly. But the other is, you know, it helps the people who are new to the scene, if they just have that humility about their claims of causality regarding the strange things that people do. You should go to California. Have you ever been to California? My foil, Berkeley. I forgot they're taping this.
To say I'm in awe of being in your presence. I read your book twice. I was in Maria's class.
Do you like chapter 5?
On page 135, is that chapter 5? Is that part of chapter 5?
I don't know. Not that self-reference.
I worked as a neonatal nurse practitioner for 25 years before I entered religious life. And there's something that you had written. First, I like to say it's the preferential option of the poor in healthcare that really spoke to me.
Yeah.
And you write, how do we make the journey after conversion? And a conversion for me, coming from another faith into Catholicism, but then
the faith of neonatology,
the faith of Judaism, but then neonatology, but seeing the poor in a different way, and yeah, however you want to define poor. But you wrote, it's how to make that journey part of the transformative change we will need to end poverty and related pathologies that matters most, accompanying the destitute sick on a journey away from premature suffering and death, out of the country of social suffering through the door of yes. I'm wondering, looking at our own United
States... Could you read it again?
looking at our own United States, what is your opinion of the Affordable Health Care Act? You know, we have gross obesity, hypertension, diabetes. People are dying young and with all the sequela from all those diseases. And yet we have a Congress that's fighting desperately to repeal health care that is taking care of our poor right here in our own neighborhood. So I was just curious, as a physician, what is your opinion of the Affordable Health Care Act?
Well, I mean, I hope they fail at trying to repeal. Is that clear enough? We have as a nation, you know, we just have a very bad report card, and as you know, on health outcomes and all measures of well-being. You know, we, to use a sports metaphor, since we're in Chicago, we punch way below our weight class. Did I pull that off? This is like a major. Mark that down, Father Mark. And you know, it's shameful, right? And last time I was here in Chicago, I wasn't trying to win points talking about a trauma desert, right? But this is the third largest city in the nation, the city of broad shoulders. Not so broad, however, that there isn't shockingly differential mortality after trauma in this beautiful, stunning city. And, you know, there are huge parts of the United States that are public health deserts. There are huge parts of the United States that are clinical deserts. And they're sometimes crowded together, you know, next to each other. Not all of that, as you know very well, although after 25 years, I'm sure you'll agree with me that you look at prematurity and low birth weight babies, and it's the same story, that the inequalities already started before, you know, the lungs mature. And, you know, just looking at this problem of A, differential risks for something bad, getting hit by a car, getting diabetes, and then B, differential risk for a poor outcome once afflicted. You know, healthcare isn't everything, but it's something. There is no pathology among those that you just mentioned, and certainly not Ebola, in which it wouldn't make a huge difference to address B as well as the social determinants of these disparities. But what is very disturbing to me, and which I was saying to Father Mark, we don't hear a lot from, back to the encouragement that I mentioned. We get more encouragement from you. But you know what we get, and you might be spared a little bit if you were a NICU nurse, but what we get is a withering critique, pitting prevention against care, right? So, yesterday I was in at a small community-based college in Cambridge, Massachusetts, called Harvard, and I was with friends, and the Thai health minister, who is also a friend actually, the Thai government has been pushing forward universal health care, you know, unambivalently since 2001. So in 1991, they had the usual paltry showing, right, in terms of coverage for a catastrophic illness or something like a premature baby or Ebola, you know, or leukemia, right? And then after changing legislation, they leapt into the 90s. And their big concern is how to get from 99 to 100 and how to keep adding things to the list of what's covered in their Affordable Care Act. We spend 16% of our GDP, or 17%, they spend 4%. And among the, you know, people say, well, but they don't have renal dialysis. Oh, yes, they do, right? Or, well, they don't have NICUs. Oh yeah, they do. But when you start trying to serve poor people, whether in the United States or somewhere else, really, that's what I mean about the withering critique. Is it's, well, you have to focus on prevention rather than care. And I asked a question last night, but I should have said it more starkly, because he was talking about trauma and building a culture of safety and the minister. And I said, well, you know, what if you already were hit by a car? Now, what I should have said is, I was hit by a car as a med student. That's what I should have said, because then it would have had the intended, you know, effect not the intended effect. I mean, it sounds rhetorical, but you know, that's what I was trying to get at, is, you know, when we may make a preferential option for in health care, as you, I think, picked up, we're trying to avoid this nihilism of, well, if you're poor, you choose, you know, NICUs or prenatal care. How many times did you hear that in the 25 years? I mean, we got hammered with that every class we took in public health or social medicine, which, by the way, were very few in medical school or nursing school, right? You really don't study those things, but when we did, it was NICUs versus prenatal care. But what if you already have a preemie? So I should have said, I was hit by a car. And in fact, not 500 yards from where the current king of Thailand was born, at the Mount Auburn Hospital. Okay, intersection of Fresh Pond Parkway and Huron Avenue. And I'm lying there in the street, and after 4 years, or close to 4 years of med school, I was on my way to Haiti. That's why I was rushing. Heedless, lack of safety culture. My leg is going like this, and I try to get up, and I fell back on the street, and I thought, oh, my leg is broken. Great diagnostician in the making. So then, of course, there's a huge traffic jam. Ambulances show up, and they lean over me. It's a rather unusual perspective for a med student. And I'm looking at them, they're looking down at me, and then now it's starting to rain. Yes. And they said, well, young fellow, looks like you broke your leg. I said, yeah, looks like I broke my leg. We'll be taking you to Santa Maria Hospital. I thought, I've never heard of Santa Maria Hospital. I'm a fourth year medical student at Harvard. That's a bad sign. But I didn't say that. I would never offend the nuns who were probably running it. And, it's not that Haiti had much more impact on me than that did. It was almost banal. It wasn't banal. I couldn't walk for 3 months, right? But I knew I was going to get care. I knew that I had health insurance. Never thought of it before. I knew that my mother didn't have health insurance. And in fact, growing up, although my mother would probably be embarrassed by this, but with a family of eight, my guess was that more often than not, we had no health insurance. We just were lucky that the social determinants of disease meant that as young, otherwise healthy, uninsured Americans, we were not likely to need Plan B, a preferential option for the uninsured in health care. And so that's a long answer to your question, but I don't see any way forward except what the Thai did, with considerably fewer resources, not even a fraction, and by any assessment, right? They said, well, we've got to find a way to cover all of our people with health insurance, with protection from catastrophic illness and the expenditures associated with it. And what would have happened to my family of eight if someone in our family did get leukemia? Or if I'd been hit by a car before I went to Harvard? The cost of my medical care, the surgeries, the transfers, all that, which I already told you was banal, was more than twice my mother's salary as a grocery store cashier. So that's how I feel about Obamacare. And, I wish there weren't crazy misaligned incentives. I don't know much about it, right? We should know a lot about it, doctors and nurses. We should know everything about it. But how are you going to read something that's, 8,000 pages long? I like that you read my book instead. It just goes right to the punchline. For insurance against lack of protection. Love, Paul. Right. How'd I do? I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled. That is from chapter 5. So there.
My name is Min. I'm with the SPD. And I'm deeply
superventricular dysfunction.
And I'm deeply touched by all the work that you do. And just wondering, would you like to share with us what is your greater vision, the dream, or the more imagination behind the work that you do? And what would be the virtue that you believe that encourage you to fulfill the dream and your imagination? And what is the greatest enemy of that moral imagination? Because in some of your writings, you mentioned about partnership and mediocrity. So can you please talk more about that? Thank you.
You guys are tough. It's like, can I get an easy question? Well, the dream, and I think it's a perfectly fine way of putting it. I'm going to be banal again and say, if I am, if you're planting a garden. Do you have a garden? It's awfully cold here. Where are you from originally? Yeah. So say you're planting a garden. You can see something. If you plant a tree, even, right? You don't see it as a little sapling. You see it as something it might be. And I think it is possible to have some notion of equity. Let me just turn your attention to the New York Times today. Just because I was on a plane and I went into the airport in Boston and went looking for it. I kind of stole it, actually. Will you absolve me? The newspaper. I didn't steal it. I just didn't pay for it. I mean, I asked someone for it. Now I'm really nervous. And there's an article. Oh, no, it's the New Yorker. I bought that. $5. And the New Yorker, which I'll give you my copy, because you've probably taken vows of poverty or something. So the New Yorker, the first, I love the New Yorker. I'm saying that as a professor, read the New Yorker. You know, it's well written. You know, I'll buy you a subscription, okay? But the first, in every week there's something called Talk of the Town, and the first one's always the best one, and it's usually going to be about something like the great dilemmas before us. You know, climate change or healthcare insurance. Always about something like that. Something of moment. Ferguson. I bet next week will probably be about Baltimore. Okay, but today it's about migration. Philip Gurevich wrote it. It's about Lampedusa and people losing their lives in the Mediterranean. But he starts in Vietnam. You knew that I knew that you were from Vietnam, right? I guessed. So he starts in Vietnam, 1988, and boat people. I'm not sure what year it was, but boat people, people getting on a boat, 110 of them, and they're really trafficked, right? They're paying money to leave, right? And their boat is, as you can imagine, is not made for 110 people, and they're heading, I think, for the Philippines. Who knows where they were heading? And they're in distress, and people began to die of exposure. It's actually, I think, a well-known story, but I'm not going to recount the latter half of that trip and what became of the people on the boat. I think 45 or 46 survived. That's not the story that Gurevich is trying to bring out. He's noticing that a ship, an American military ship, a Navy ship, gave them supplies but did not rescue them. And, you know, the officer was sanctioned. I don't know if it was court-martialed. This morning I read this, right, on the way here. And for dereliction of duty, right? And then he goes back to the Mediterranean. And what's happening right now? What happened last week and what's been happening this past year? And his last words are, "We know dereliction of duty when we see it." And I think he's right. The dream is equitable health care for everybody. And what's the marker for that? Poor people. People who are unprotected, uninsured, neglected, the victims of all kinds of other structural violence. And the question I would have is, would I recognize that if I saw it? I think I would. I think you would too. You know, you would not be seeing these arguments about, well, you know, what if the ambulance drivers had said to me, you should have looked both ways before you walk across the street. But that's what we do to poor people, you know. Shouldn't have had so many kids. Now you got a preemie. And so I think that's the dream. This equity dream, which sounds so vague, has this, you know, incredible specificity, like a tree, like not failing to intervene and save someone's life on the high seas, which, you know, is a code of not just customary law, but it clearly must even be a code of American law if they're going to sanction a military person for failure, for dereliction of duty. And that's why I think the dream is the opposite of that, and that there are remarkable specificities that we can look for. And others I can look for, and you could do the, you know, and or others would recognize and be able to encourage and not dismiss as just some vague notion that could never be realized. And that kind of, so you asked what the greatest poison is. You might not have used that. Did you, what was your word was?
Enemy.
Poison's generally an enemy, though. And I think it is that, you know, that belief that we don't have to apply that standard to poor people. To, you know, and then fill in the blank, you know, poor people of another race, creed, you know, the you know, I'm using poor as the marker of neglect. And but there are other forms of discrimination, as we all know. And I think that's the biggest poison. It's not, you know, this has been said by, probably in Vietnam, that, you know, every time I was, as I was saying, I was teaching with the March of Sen last fall, and I would be talking about something that happened 100 years ago and think I had great historical depth, and he'd always go, well, 2,000 years ago, or in 3,000 BC, you could do that in Vietnam too, because there's a long tradition. But I'm American. We're of recent vintage. So, you know, that's the poison. It's not, you know, it's not that people go out and say, you know, there's really nothing we can do for those boat people, or, you know, we're under orders to proceed directly to the Persian Gulf, or, you know, it's not really cost effective to build a NICU in rural Haiti, even though there are a lot of premature babies, or we can't have a trauma service in Haiti, even though an earthquake has just destroyed, you know, the entire medical education system, the nursing school, a complete loss. The Ministry of Health gone from 5 stories to 1, and then you have to have those discussions about rebuilding a proper modern hospital. That's the enemy, is the low ball aspirations we have for other people. And, you know, that's like back to the nuns. It all goes back to the nuns. You know, I don't think, you can sit down, Sam. I'm just getting warmed up. I don't think that, they never let me do this at the hospital. I don't think that, you know, I think you'd get called out for that in your circles. Right? Say, we can't differentially value other people because they're poor, or fill in the blank. And that's the poison. And, you know, you can't go out, another sports metaphor, swinging, roundhouse, anyway, never mind. I'm a pacifist. You can't go out saying this stuff just anywhere. That's why I told Father Mark, I'm happy to be here. This is a, you know, day where I can say whatever is on my mind and know that it's not going to be regarded as assaultive. Or, you know, but that's what I think. They say, yeah, we can recognize the dream, and we know the opposite too when we see it. Is this the hook?
Okay, Mark, can I ask a question?
Sure.
How long have you been in Haiti?
32 years? Not that I'm counting.
No, I'm just curious. I was wondering as I'm listening to you, and do you ever get those moments when you wonder if you've made a difference And what is it that motivates you to keep going, even though you do see a five-story building go down to one story? And I've been down to Haiti a number of times. I'm going back in another week. And it doesn't look any different. And I just wonder how and what keeps you going.
Yeah.
Most of the people in this room, most, I would presume, have gospel values that keep them going. Could possibly be your values. And I was just wondering, because it's a tough situation there in many places throughout the world. And then also, do you have any relations with St. Damien and St. Luke's Hospital in Port-au-Prince?
Thank you.
You know, just starting with that example of St. Damien's, you know, I think longitudinal experience with the people who've been working there, meaning over time, you'd say, oh, well, there's something that can be done, right? You just point to it. So, and that's been my experience in Haiti, is, you know, just stopping and say, wait, okay, 32 years ago, 31 years ago, 30, 25, 10. So the answer but the answer to your question is, of course, there are times when all of us feel, I'm sure that happens in Chicago, you know, when you're doing tough work here. I'm sure, you know, just reading about Baltimore, you know, this is not in the New Yorker, but in the New York Times, about one of the people there who'd been working on building that senior center, you know, and I just was thinking, God, what must he feel like? He's, you know, born and raised there, and now has gospel values, or at least one would assume since he's a reverend, but, you know, what would that feel like? So the answer to part A of the question is for sure. But part B is any experience over time shows, in fact, significant improvement. First of all I would have to do to lift my spirits without even looking at something or some people who are either pulled out of poverty or now able to work in health and social justice, you know, the nurses, doctors, managers that we've trained, because we've always linked our work to formal training programs in schools. The way we train doctors, is, I'm sure you know, is through, and nurses too, is through basically internship and residency programs. But doing that in Haiti over 15 years, 20 years, you see them all. Last night, you know, one of the I was giving a talk at the medical school, Harvard Medical School, and it's my job, right? But then to a dinner with the Thai health minister, who I just heard his talk. I went to join them. And who should go with me but one of the Harvard graduate students, who happens to be one of the Haitian doctors who we train, you know, and he's brilliant, you know? And that's part of it. Even before looking at a place like St. Damien's, the new iteration, or Mirbalet University Hospital, which is really quite beautiful. Some of you have been there. Has anybody been to Mirbalet? Oh, great. What an endorsement. Take that back about the encouragement. It is beautiful. Take my word for it. It's a modern medical center in the middle of rural Haiti. And it's probably the largest solar-powered hospital in the developing world. It's got a CAT scanner, right? And, you know, St. Damien's, they like it too. You know, we share patients. But to be honest, when those moments do strike, which I think we're all heir to, you know, just look at the numbers. What was infant mortality 32 years ago? What was maternal mortality? What was juvenile mortality? These things are important. What's happened to the economy? So all these cycles of reversal and setback, including the earthquake and the horrible political violence over the decades, is still not adding up to defeat. It's actually, things are getting better by standard measures and by the measures of, if you're involved with good works, as you are, because St. Damien's is surely one of them, so is Mirbalet, so is Conge, which, you know, started 30, 40 years ago. So I would, you know, and I think also we've got to look out for each other, right? So I work with thousands of people in Haiti alone, including my trainees, who are now my former trainees, and will, you know, replace me. And that's also very uplifting. And I encourage those of you who are involved in that kind of work, find your way to be involved in the training of the next generation. We need, by the way, Haitian philanthropy among Haitians, middle-class Haitians or elite Haitians. Here we are, we're all middle-class and up in this room, or will be, right? Where are the philanthropists, and where are the social justice people from, you know? And the answer is, among the wealthy, there's a lot of work to be done to build an interest in addressing, you know, not necessarily work by me and you, but among young people. That's something that we need, more young Haitians like you or me, I would like to say, or anyone in this room, who are going to be, you know, really committed long term to addressing these disparities that are so obvious in Haiti. And I'm very optimistic about that. When we went to Rwanda for the first time 10 years ago to work, who went with us? The Haitians. Malawi, the Haitians. The head of PIH Liberia, Haitian, former student of mine. I could go on. So I'm just saying, they're a font of inspiration for me, in spite of the frustrations, in spite of the disappointments, and in spite of the cruel experience of 2010. But there's real progress being made. And the more you can hook into those young people and see them, you know, 20 years later, 30 years later, doing health and social justice work, or education and social justice, or whatever, social justice work, that's very uplifting too. Anyway. Well, have a good trip back there, by the way, and give my regards to the terrific team there. The Hook.